Our current guest lives with his family in the shadows of the Rocky Mountains. After completing his MBA at Harvard Business School, he played a key role in establishing the Kobe Leadership Center, first as a client developer, later on as national sales manager, and then eventually as president and CEO. Many people refer to themselves as thought leaders on their social media profiles. No doubt our current guest certainly is. He advises companies, entrepreneurs, and decision makers from various social institutions. He is a much sought-after speaker, and his books are worldwide bestsellers. With his work, he continues the work set out by his father, who wrote the book The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, probably one of the most important books on the subject of vision-led life. He strongly believes that trust is the new currency of our interdependent and collaborative world.
For over 3 years, we are on our way to new work. How can a topic that plays such an important part in our everyday life create more meaning in our lives again? How do we get people to draw strength and motivation from their daily work again? And how can one succeed in living a happy, healthy, productive, and fulfilling life even in such difficult times? We're looking for methods, role models, experiences, tools, and ideas that brings us closer to the core of new work. We are always concerned with the question of whether everyone can really, really find and live what they really, really want in their innermost being. You're at On the Way to New Work today with Stephen M. R. Covey, and we can't wait to speak with him about what trust means to him in the podcast today.
Hello.
Hello, Christoph and Michael. Great to be with you.
You're so happy and so proud.
And I give a little bit of the setting so that everyone can follow what we have. We have a laptop here. We see Stephen with an amazing, clear DSLR video picture and with a good sound. And Michael and I sit in Michael's library and had already a conversation ahead. And we are thrilled to dive into the topics, what happens at the moment in the world when it comes to work and leadership. So really excited.
As we mentioned, the work of your family, your father and all the members of the family really influenced Christoph's and my, not just work, but our life. And this since, in my case, since more than 20 years. And the first question we always ask, and then this time it's I'm really, really curious about the answer is, how did you become the person you're right now with such a strong family background?
Yeah, well, first of all, I feel that I was very blessed and fortunate to have such a good family with my father and my mother. My mother was my father's equal. And, you know, people know about my father and his work on the 7 habits. And so for me, I kind of grew up learning the 7 habits because it was taught in our home. And in fact, my brothers and sisters, we were the first audience for my father on his ideas, and he'd always test it with us. And then he'd go out and present to corporations, organizations, business, you know, government, healthcare. But we felt like we were the very first to hear his ideas and his thinking. And that was a blessing and a unique opportunity for me that really influenced me in very significant ways that have kind of, it's become like the software of my mind.
Wow.
It's given me a way of interpreting the world and seeing it through the lens of leadership and of people and a belief in people and, you know, of trying to unleash human potential. And I kind of learned that from my father. And so anything I've done, I'm just standing on the shoulders of a giant and trying to, you know, continue his legacy and to do some things that are meaningful. Cause my father was all about contribution and making a difference and mattering. And that's why I'm so drawn to the work that you two are doing. And with this podcast on the way to new work, you know, because you're bringing meaning and purpose and contribution to this, as well as other dimensions of how work is done and where. And that's inspiring to me. So that's part of my DNA. And I was fortunate to kind of learn it in my home, and not, you know, not everyone has that opportunity. And that's, I don't take that for granted. It was a blessing. And then I've tried to apply it in the different leadership roles and responsibilities that I've taken on. But I give so much attribution back to my father.
Wow. Yeah, wow. And thank you so much for painting the picture and that feedback. Do you remember a time as a kid or young adult when one of the seven habits resonated with you, when you remember, okay, this was kind of the first time I kind of, yeah, can relate back to that moment?
Well, I can, yes. In fact, my father writes about it in The Seven Habits. And it was when I was just a young boy, 7 years old. And this is the story that he calls Green and Clean. Green and Clean, for those that are familiar with The Seven Habits. And the idea was, he was trying to empower me, delegate to me the responsibility to take care of our lawn, of our yard. And we had a big, big lawn with a lot of grass. And this was, you know, back in the days before they had automatic sprinklers, you had to manually do it. And he said to me, "Son, I want you to take care of our yard. I'm going to give you the responsibility." He called it a stewardship. And your job is to make sure that the lawn is green and clean. And he said, you know, those are results words. How you achieve green and clean is up to you. You can choose your methods. I just want the results, green and clean. But again, I'm a young boy. So he trained me for like 2 weeks and taught me how to turn on the sprinklers and how frequently to turn them on. And then, you know, that would keep the yard green. And then the clean, he, you know, taught me how to, you know, clean up the garbage and things that would be on the lawn. And so for 2 weeks, he trained me to take care of the lawn. And then after 2 weeks, he said, "Okay, are you ready to take this on?" And I said, "Okay, Dad, I'm ready." So he turned it over to me. And then right after he turned over to me, for the next like 5 days, I did absolutely nothing. I didn't turn on the sprinklers. I didn't clean up the yard. And you know, I'm a 7-year-old boy. I was just out in the neighborhood playing ball with the other people. And the lawn, this was in the middle of the summer. Mm. And so the lawn is starting to turn yellow by the day because it's not being watered. And our neighbors right next door have these beautiful manicured, clean, green lawns. And our lawn was yellow with garbage strewn all throughout. And my father said that he was kind of just ready to take back the responsibility and say, you know, he's too young. You know, this won't work with a 7-year-old. But he didn't. He stayed with it. He had given me, you know, this was really around the idea of habit 4, think win-win, a win-win agreement, he called it. That, you know, that I would learn how to take on this responsibility and make the yard green and clean. But I remember what he said to me was, because we had agreed as part of our agreement that once a week that we would walk around together and I would tell him how I'm doing on the lawn. And so he, after about 5 days of doing nothing, he took me out and said, "Why don't we walk around and see how things are going?" So we start to walk around the lawn and you know, it's yellow and there's garbage everywhere. It was anything but green and clean. And so again, as a young boy, I started to break down and cry. And I said, "But Dad, this is just so hard." And he said, "Well, what's hard? You haven't done one thing yet." And you know, but what was hard was me learning how to take responsibility, how to be proactive and to show initiative and to take the responsibility of doing this. And my dad said, you know, if you'd like, I could help you. I've got time. I said, would you help me? He said, yeah, I've got time. So I ran into the house and I grabbed two garbage sacks and I came out and I gave one to my dad and I said, would you take this garbage sack and go around and pick up the garbage? Because, you know, it makes me vomit when I see this. And my dad says, sure, I'm your helper. And so here I am, a seven-year-old boy directing my father to help me clean up the yard. And he's following my lead because he had delegated this responsibility to me. And he stayed in character to that. Instead of taking it back from me, even when I wasn't doing it, he said, no, you're responsible. How can I help you? And then I started to direct him. And when I saw this happen, at that moment was when this job became mine and I owned it. And it was a work that I wanted to do. And I realized I'm responsible. Look, my father is following my direction. Mm-hmm. And from that moment on, I took care of the yard. And you know, for that summer and many, many summers thereafter, and I made sure the yard was green and clean. And my father would, you know, talk about this story for years about how it's a good example of a win-win performance agreement in habit four, or stewardship delegation in habit three, which is put first things first and I can delegate, or even habit one, be proactive of learning to take responsibility. You know, it's all those habits in some form. But for me, I was 7 years old. I didn't understand what a win-win performance agreement was, but here's what I knew as a seven-year-old. I felt trusted. Mm. I felt my father trusted me and I didn't want to let him down. That was kind of the first defining moment that I kind of remember feeling, not just hearing, but feeling the principles my father taught. And that's where I started to become enamored with this idea of trust and being trusted, what it does to people, because I saw what it did for me as a seven-year-old. That's my first kind of the greatest memory of where I not just heard my father's words, but I felt and experienced them.
Amazing story. It's for me, it's a perfect analogy for a concept which is called servant leadership. That the leader, in this case, your father, has a leading role, is a servant leader. He really has a goal and a system, and he want to serve the system. He does not want to dominate it, to control it. He want to serve it, and he empowers you. So it's a fabulous example on so many levels. Thanks for sharing. Yeah,
I agree with that. It is servant leadership.
Yeah. When you became then a little bit older, let's say coming into your puberty, was there any time where you tried to revolve or to try to say, well, I'm not going to do this anymore, I want to do my own stuff, or was this so strong that you developed into this system over your whole period as a young man?
Sure, there were times, and you know, I'm like everybody else, and there were times where I kind of wanted to chart my own path and do my own thing and didn't want to follow these, you know, what my father was teaching. So I kind of had to learn my own way and come back to this. But the great thing about it is that my father never, and when I say my father, I should also add my mother, my parents, they never used any form of compulsion, of force. It was always choice. It was always options. And they taught, you know, that's really habit one, be proactive, that things happen to us. That's our stimulus. And then there's our response to the things that happen to us. And in between the stimulus and response, there is a space. Mm. And in that space is our choice, our freedom to choose our response. And I went through some periods where, you know, I wanted to rebel a little. But I found over time that I realized the consequences of choosing, you know, alternate paths of not being a kind person or being mean, you know, and that I didn't like the outcomes. And so I learned by myself kind of over time that this is that what my father was teaching was a better path that I wanted to follow for myself, not because my father told me I should. And that was kind of an ongoing process. So yeah, we were like any other family, except for we had a lot of kids. There was a big family growing up, but we weren't perfect. And my father wasn't perfect either. Someone asked him one time, do you live the seven habits yourself? And he said, yeah, about 80% of the time. And his point was, yeah. Look, I'm trying, I'm doing my best, but I also make mistakes, you know, but I always come back. I'm always course correcting. And he, you know, he'd use the analogy of an airplane, let's say traveling from Hamburg to London, and it might be, you know, gets up in the air, and then it might be slightly off course most of the time, but it's just always course correcting, just minor course corrections as it's up there, but it ends up landing at its destination. And so it's, you know, even though it had to course correct a whole bunch along the way, and that's the idea, is that, you know, we're always course correcting, improving, getting feedback, making it better, but we ultimately try to arrive at our destination. And so that's what it's all about. But we were like any other family, nothing truly special, other than I think we had some special ideas of leadership that we were privileged to be taught.
Yeah. Let me just dive into one of the seven habits a little bit deeper, which is begin with the end in mind, because it was the breakthrough moment for me when I read the book for the first time, which was 1993. My former boss gave it to me and said, if you read this book, you will understand me. And when I came to this funeral example, where you have to imagine that you don't live any longer and that your best friend is standing there next to your grave and is holding the speech about your life. And then your father gave the advice to me, to the reader, now what would you want him to say? And this was so strong for me that I had to read this book, I think, every 3 or 4 years again to ask myself this question. And and what I can see now over the last period of the more than 240 podcasts we did is that this has such a strong comeback. So the whole discussion about purpose in life, we discussed this up front. So it's so strong now. Do you think this is the strongest habit, or do you say it just makes sense if you follow all seven habits?
Well, I actually think that's really interesting that you would highlight that one, Michael, because many times my father would be asked, you know, what's the most important of the seven habits? And honestly, at different times, I probably heard him answer each of the seven. but I'll never forget the one time when I heard him say, habit two, begin with the end in mind by far. Mm. Because he said, because that is the habit in which you write the script. You know, and he makes the point, you're not a program, you're a programmer. Therefore, write the program, create your future, you know, and we don't have to just follow the scripts we've been given. We can create, we can write our script. We can decide what's important to us, what matters. Begin with the end in mind, envision either our funeral, or he later amended it to say, maybe it's your 80th birthday party, so that
which
you're still alive.
So much nicer. Yeah.
Yeah. Your 80th birthday party. And you've got, you know, friends from the community and neighbors, and you have someone from work, and someone from, you know, different parts of your life. And what do you want them to say? Your exact point, Michael. And so it's a great way of thinking about it. But when you do that, you're drawn to not just spending more time at the office. You're really drawn to what you're focused on the way to new work, of bringing purpose to it and meaning, because you want to matter and you want to make a difference and you want contribution. You want relationships. We're whole people, not just, you know, economic beings that just work only for a living, but we want to, you know, we have a body, a heart, a mind, and a spirit, so that we want to be engaged wholly and have our work matter. You know this so well with what you're doing and the work that you're leading. So all seven habits are important, but that's a critical one, because that one sets the course. That one defines the vision. And where you become clear of what your mission is, what your purpose is, what matters to you. And without knowing that, you know, then you can really bounce all around. But once you know that and have a sense of that, it's powerful. It's powerful. I'm reminded of the quote by Pablo Picasso. And this reminds me of habit two. You know, he said, "The meaning of life is to find your gift, and the purpose of life is to give it away."
Oh, wow.
And that comes around, you know, habit two: find your gift and give it away. The meaning, find your gift, the purpose, give it away. And that's, you know, habit two, that's finding your voice and the like. So that's obviously a beautiful habit.
And it's the one that is closely also related to the idea of new work, where the question is asked, what do you really, really want? And many people misinterpret the question, say, doing what you want. And we always say, yes, but it comes with a responsibility. And I just showed Michael, I have, inspired by that, I have a timer on my phone. It counts 18,732 days. It's up until my 90th birthday. So it's kind of the idea to have that in my mind. But it took me, I would say, up until last year to really truly have the moment that I would also feel what is to me the purpose and what do I want to give away. And this really resonated with me when you connected the story of your father with your personal story and saying, that's the moment when I felt, for example, that trust is important. And this is something I believe in the times we live in right now, it's very easy to get drawn away by watching too many videos, reading too many books, instead of following certain things, listening to too many podcasts, instead of like doing it, you can easily become distracted instead of saying like, how does it resonate with you? How does it make you feel? And I would like to know, what was the time when you for yourself really truly had the feeling and you could like deal with it on a rational base, when you know that's the direction I want to go in? Or was it a zigzag course? Was it a straight line? It's from looking backwards, it always looks like a straight line. It never is usually. And I would really be interested in that moment.
Yeah, I think there have probably been a couple of times where I become quite clear about my purpose, but I have to be reminded about it because life happens. And you get distracted and you can get off course easy in the, you know, in the burst of activities and things that, you know, come at you and, you know, that are urgent, that may or may not be important, may or may not be tied to your purpose, your mission, and to your sense of contribution. But I remember it was after I was graduating from business school and I'd worked in real estate development prior, and I really liked that a lot. And I had an opportunity to go back into that. And I also worked in on Wall Street for a short stint in investment banking. I had an opportunity to go into that. And then my father was about to launch his company and write his book, The Seven Habits. And he invited me to be a part of this. So I had these three opportunities in front of me. And, you know, one was the most attractive one financially in the short term, you know, the investment banking New York City, Wall Street, pretty exciting. I'd done that, you know, for a short stint, and I had a great opportunity. A lot of appeal to that. Mm. And the real estate development was also appealing because that was in Texas, in Dallas, and it was the wild frontier of developing, you know, beautiful buildings and you know, it was very alluring as well. And then my father had this little small company that had only been in business for a few years, consulting firm, doing, you know, just barely surviving, but he had this book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People that was going to come out. And I knew that book was going to resonate with people. Mm. And I knew that it could make a difference. But I was, you know, kind of debating what to do. And I remember my father asked me a question, you know, cause I was thinking about the real estate, and he said, well, do you want to build buildings or build people? And I thought about that. And I said, you know what really does inspire me is building people and seeing potential developed and seeing people become their best selves. And that inspired me. And so I said, you know, that's what I want to do is build people. And so I chose that path. Now look, for somebody else, it might've been build buildings. And that's good too, because that does important work. That creates contribution, and you also can build an organization. So I'm not saying good or bad, right and wrong. Mm-hmm. No, many right paths. It's what's my right path? What was best for me? But I'd been so kind of conditioned around the idea of contribution and trying to unleash human potential. Because I saw my father do it in me. I saw him do it in others. And I became inspired by it. And I said, I want to do a similar thing. So I went down that path of saying, yeah, that was one moment where I chose to say, I'm going to take the risk and go with the young fledgling organization that we didn't know if it was going to survive because it didn't have any cash, but it had a chance to maybe make a dent in the universe, to quote Steve Jobs, you know, to make a difference and to matter. And then I had to relive it again, you know, some years later when I left after being at Covey Leadership Center that became Franklin Covey. And I was there for some 13 years. And then I left and kind of debating what do I want to do now for my next phase? And again, I was thinking a lot of different things, but I came back to saying, you know what? I still feel drawn towards the idea of leadership and people. And that's where I focused on writing my book, The Speed of Trust, which was all about saying, if you, as a leader, if you can build trust intentionally in all relationships and on teams and in organizations, that will have a greater impact than any other competency of a leader that you could ever imagine, because it's high leverage. It will multiply every other competency that you have. And I became drawn to that. And that's my contribution. So I've probably had two moments early on in my career. And then later in my career, as I've thought about, all right, what's my next act? When I kind of had gone down the business path of helping build and run my father's company, I kind of then wanted to do my own thing. But I then again came back to saying, you know, and I dabbled in a few things in traditional business, but I came back to saying, no, my heart, my passion is around unleashing human potential and leadership and leadership development, because, you know, leadership is the highest of all the arts, because it enables every other art, every other discipline. You know, you think about it, the purpose of medicine is to heal people. But if you have bad leadership, you'll have bad medicine. The purpose of education is to teach people. But if you have bad leadership, you'll have bad education. We need great leadership to have the great effectiveness in the other professions. So leadership unlocks all those. And that is what I feel like my purpose, my passion, my vision is. But I've had to kind of come back to it a few times, but now it burns inside of me and gives me a sense of meaning. And I know you know this well, because this is a big part of New Work.
Yes, and we can feel the fire, definitely.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. Maybe we talk a little bit before we talk about your latest project or your new project about the trust book. I read that you, when you started the work on this book, you had the observation that we are living in an age of declining trust. What was the reason for this? Why do you think did this happen and still happens?
Yeah, and it's since writing it, it's probably continuing that decline. Most measures show that, you know, depending on what, you know, what snapshot you look at. But generally, we're living in a world of declining trust in our institutions, in our society at large. Many reasons for it, including, you know, 24/7 news media and social media and the like, where, you know, mistakes are instantly put out there, and you know, and if there's any deceit or fraud and misbehavior, everyone knows about it instantly, and we, you know, scandals, all these things. And when all these things happen, we all become a little bit more careful, more cautious, more guarded, because none of us want to get burned. And then we lead out more careful, cautious, and guarded, and that tends to perpetuate what I call a vicious downward cycle of distrust and suspicion that tend to create more distrust and suspicion. I've seen it happen in organizations where, you know, where leaders don't trust their people. And in turn, the people, the employees, don't trust their leaders. And they find themselves in a, you know, vicious, distrustful cycle where it's just going down. And there's more suspicion. And so distrust is contagious. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening in many societies in countries, and it's certainly happening in where I'm at right now in the United States. You know, in our society, there's such distrust, but it happens, then that seeps into organizations. But it also works the other direction. Trust and confidence can create more trust and confidence, where people are inspired by it. And when they extend trust, they rise to the occasion and they perform better and they give it back. They reciprocate the trust being given. And that also is a contagious, that becomes a virtuous upward spiral where you create more of it. So it is kind of a low trust world, and that's our context. And so my point to leaders is that rather than just kind of accept that it's difficult to build trust in a low trust world or in big organizations, I'm saying, no, trust is learnable. It is a skill. It is a competency. It is something that you can learn and do and create and grow and establish and expand. And in some cases, even restore when it's been lost. And you can build trust on purpose. And that was kind of the, you know, the big idea behind the speed of trust. Well, I guess there's two big ideas. The first was that trust is financial, not just social. You know, everyone knows trust is an important social virtue, but I make the point that trust is an economic driver. It affects the speed at which we can move and the cost of everything. And when there's low trust in relationships, teams, organizations, you pay a tax. Everything takes you longer to do. Everything costs you more. It is a tax, a low trust tax, a wasted tax, and it diminishes, dilutes everything else you're trying to do. And you could put an economic value on it. But thankfully, the converse is true. And when the trust goes up in relationships, teams, organizations, in your culture, with your customers, in the marketplace, when the trust goes up, speed goes up with it. You could do everything faster. That's why I call it the speed of trust. And cost comes down, it costs you less. And that is a dividend, a high trust dividend. And you can put an economic value on that. In fact, the data shows that high trust is like a 3 times multiplier of economic performance.
Wow.
And so, you know, that's financial. That was the first breakthrough. Trust is financial, not just social. You can put a value on that. That's a paradigm shift for most people. Mm. That they've only thought of trust as soft, kind of a nice to have social virtue. And I'm saying it is that, but it's also an economic driver, a performance multiplier that you can put a value on. Suddenly, that now gets the attention of leaders everywhere because we all want to solve economic problems and opportunities. So that was the first breakthrough. And the second breakthrough was the idea I just was explaining earlier, that trust is learnable. Mm. It's not that you either have it or you don't. It's either there or it's not. That's how many people think about it, and that you can't do much about it. But I'm saying no. In the same way that you can diminish and lose trust through your behavior, you can also consciously, deliberately create it, grow it, expand it through your behavior. You can behave your way into greater trust, just like you can behave your way out of trust. And so a combination of your credibility and your behavior can help you as a leader build trust, your team build trust, your company, where that becomes your greatest strength, the currency you operate by. And I'll tell you what, in this world of new work, people want to be trusted. They're inspired by it. They perform better. You know, it's a knowledge worker age, not the old industrial age. This is new work. And no one wants to be kind of just, you know, the command and control. They don't want that. They want to be trusted. They want to be inspired. And when they are, people respond to that. And it can be like my father with me with green and clean. He can have expectations of green and clean. And even an agreed upon process for accountability that will walk around the yard once a week. But the point was, I was trusted and I responded to the trust. And the very act of giving trust helps create trust. So, you know, you earn it, but you also give it. And you need to do both to have trust. So that's kind of what my work has been about, is how trust matters financially and as a leadership, you know, in, as a leadership multiplier, but also that trust is learnable as a skill, as a competency for any leader, for any team, for any organization. You can turn it into your greatest strength.
Would you say that... this really is a question that came to my mind. If we connect the idea of new work, saying I'm responsible for the choice I make about what I really, really want, the first thing I need to learn is to trust myself when it comes to judgment, decision-making, getting onto mistakes I maybe made and take the responsibility for that. Can you elaborate a little bit on that skill? I mean, that starts very personal, and we often get the question, especially in Germany, that people say, yeah, that's a great idea, doing what you really, really want, but I have to earn money, I have to do this, I have to do that. And I understand that, but there is always a story behind a story, and you did the first steps with your company, your father did the first steps. There must be a time when this little spark of trust came onto you and you said, yes, and this is why I trust myself in that, even in times of uncertainty.
Yes, absolutely. Christoph, you're exactly right. Self-trust precedes all other trust. See, I use a metaphor the ripple effect metaphor, where the drop of water comes down, the ripples, the waves, they start at the inside and they ripple out. And the very first wave where this all begins is self-trust. Do I trust myself? Do I give to my teammates, to my partners, to my people, a leader, a person who they can trust? Is it smart for them to trust me? So it's both halves, trusting yourself and giving to others a person who they can trust. That's self-trust, and that's where it begins. In fact, it was the German philosopher, Goethe. I don't know if I pronounced his name right, but Goethe, who said, as soon as you trust yourself, you will know how to live. And so self-trust precedes all other trust. It also helps you get a sense of how to live. And we might say how to work. But it does start with that self-trust. And I like to say that if you think about it, trust is confidence. So self-trust is self-confidence. And that comes from having both character, but also competence. And the combination of character and competence makes a person credible. That's credibility. When I have character and competence, character is who I am, competence, what I can do. And when I have a sense of, I know who I am, I know what I'm about, I have a sense of integrity, which is that I'm clear on what my values are and I live by them. You know, so I walk the talk, a sense of authenticity, of integrity. That gives me power. When my intent, which also flows from my character, is that I'm seeking mutual benefit, win-win. I'm seeking to add value. I'm seeking to serve. You know, the idea of servant leadership, Michael, as you said. I'm seeking to, I care about people. I care about others. That's my intent. That when I have intent that is not just self-serving intent, but intent around contribution, creating value, serving, caring, that also gives me confidence. And so that flows from my character. And then on my competence side, the competence, the idea that I'm constantly trying to learn and improve and get better in a changing world. So I'm retooling, reskilling, you've got this great podcast where you hear from all these leaders of with ideas and all the work that you're doing of on the way to new work of coming up with tools and processes and strategies and methodologies and thinking around how to help people embrace and succeed with new work. That's always about getting better, improving our capabilities, staying relevant in a changing world. You know, that gives you confidence. And then finally, when you have a track record of performing, when you've delivered and you performed in the past, that gives you confidence. And so your character, your competence gives you gives yourself a sense of credibility. And the essence of credibility is self-trust. And from that emanates all kinds of other possibilities. But you'll have a hard time building trust with others if you don't trust yourself. So, yes.
Let's start with ourselves. amazing. I think all research shows that you are so damn right with this. I think the latest research we read was from Google when they analyzed what is the main driver for successful teams. They came up with the same. So they say, well, if you want to create a safe space, which is something you need for a strong team, trust is the first driver. So in our little conversation before we start the official podcast, you say, well, maybe trust and inspiration is the new command and control. Maybe we dig into this a little bit deeper. So trust is one thing, but inspiration is the other thing.
And related command and control is from the old industrial world, as you said it. I mean, where we...
It's Taylorism, Do you think we have already leaders with trust and inspiration as their main drivers and forces?
Yes, I do. I think we're in the midst of that shift. And this is part of my new work I'm working on. And it dovetails beautifully with what you're about. And the whole idea is that a new way of working requires a new way of leading. And so we can't continue to lead in the ways that maybe worked in the past in a different time, a different era, the industrial age. But that's not today's world. It's a knowledge worker age. It's an age of possibilities and infinite choices and options, a gig economy, a freelance economy of, and, you know, all kinds of possibilities and technology has changed everything, disruptive technology. So the world has changed. As you know and talk about, work has changed. Both the nature of the work, you know, that it's collaborative and creative, knowledge work, and increasingly innovative and in many cases team-based and such, but also where the work is being done. You know, work from home, work from anywhere, all kinds of possibilities, how the work is done. Just the options are limitless. So work has changed. The nature of the workforce has changed. We have multiple generations like never before with different hopes and dreams and expectations. And then choice has changed. We just have infinite choice and possibility. So all these forces of change have, you know, are basically saying the world has changed, but too often our way of leading has not. We're still kind of deeply scripted in the old model of command and control. It's just that we've become more sophisticated, more enlightened, you know, more benevolent. We brought more emotional intelligence to it, and strengths finder and purpose, you know, and mission. These are all good things, but if the paradigm is still kind of command and control, which is people are things, versus what I call trust and inspire, which is people aren't things, people are people. You manage things, you lead people.
People.
We need good management, we need good leadership, but the danger is when you try to manage people as if they were things. That's the old model. But trust and inspire is manage things, lead people. People don't want to be managed. People want to be led. Mm-hmm. They want to be trusted. They want to be inspired. That's what brings out the best in them. And that's where they can feel like they can give their greatest contributions. And so this is where, you know, they use the metaphor by the great Canadian hockey player, Wayne Gretzky, where he says, you know, what makes him so great at hockey is that I skate to where the puck is going to be. Mm. Not where it's at, but where it's going to be. And I believe where the puck is going today is towards inspiration and inspiring leadership. And I think the inspiration is the new engagement. It's a level beyond engagement. And I love engagement. And you know, we're trying to engage people as leaders on our teams. And the more engaged they are, the better they perform, the better the company performs, the happier. And engagement is a great thing. So I'm not downplaying in any way or denigrating engagement. It's critical. That's the discretionary effort that people choose to give, to invest. But I'm saying that there's even a higher level beyond engagement that is inspiration, where people are inspired by it. So they're not just responding to kind of motivation, which is kind of carrot and stick, you know, either rewards or punishment. And that's a relic of the industrial age of command and control of, you know, I motivate people. Now I want inspiration. And, you know, motivation is extrinsic. It's external. It's outside of me. Inspiration is intrinsic. It's internal. It's already inside of people. My job of a leader is to help ignite it. What's already there, the fire within, to help ignite it and fan the flames of people's already existing fires that are inside of them, which is for many people, the new work that's inside of them. And leadership needs to be about inspiring that, igniting that. You know, inspire comes from the Latin term inspirare. I don't think I pronounced that right.
Oh, you did.
But no one knows how to pronounce Latin today. So, but that means to breathe into. So I'm breathing life into something that maybe had been lifeless, but the capacity, the potential was inside of people already. I'm just trying to ignite it, breathe into it so that, you know, it's already there. That's what's needed. And so inspiration. And I think that as leaders, you might say, well, gosh, to inspire people, you've got to be charismatic. And I'm not charismatic, or, you know, but But I don't think that's the case. I know many people who are charismatic who are not inspiring. I know other people who are not necessarily charismatic, but are very inspiring. And because they believe in people and they model the behavior. They're leading out by modeling it. And then they trust people. And when you trust people, that inspires them. In fact, I would say this: to be trusted is the most inspiring form of human motivation. It brings out the very best in all of us, just like my father did with me as a 7-year-old boy. The best was brought out in me because I was trusted. And I think the equivalent of that happens in our lives when we're trusted. So when you model behavior, that inspires people. Model, you know, when you lead out and you're a model of humility and courage and you know, doing, you know, character and competence. When you trust people, that inspires them. But I also think what inspires people is when you connect with them and you show caring for them and you connect with their purpose, their why. You help them find their why, their meaning. They have to do it for themselves, but you create the conditions for them to do it. They find their new work. You show a caring for that, and you connect with people this way. And then when you do one more thing, when you connect to purpose and you try to create and embed purpose, meaning, and contribution into the work you're doing, that inspires people. And so my premise is that everyone can inspire, not just the charismatic. And that's, you know, because you can inspire by modeling, you can inspire by trusting, and you can inspire by connecting with people and connecting to purpose. And everyone can learn to do that and get good at that. And so suddenly, everyone can become a trust and inspire leader. We got to do habit two. We have to begin with the end in mind. We have to write the script and not just go with the scripts we've been given. The old industrial age model of command and control, it's not going to work in today's world. You can't command and control your way to greater innovation and collaboration. No, we've got to trust and inspire our teams and our culture. So this is what's needed today. I'll give you one little example because you asked for, are there people that are doing this? The example I'll give is Microsoft. And Satya Nadella, their new CEO, is a great example of trust and inspire. And, you know, he followed Steve Ballmer, who might be more the traditional old school model. And you know he did a lot of good things and got a lot of mileage and out of the old school model and a lot of motivation, but you know you might describe it as more an enlightened command and control. But Satya Nadella, you wouldn't describe him as charismatic per se, but he models the kind of leadership that's needed. So he goes first and models it. He trusts his people. And he inspires them by connecting with them, showing caring and a sense of belonging, but then by embedding purpose, meaning, and contribution with everything that they're doing. And Microsoft was kind of seen as, you know, around 2014, 2015 as kind of, it's a company that has had its best days, that yeah, they're all in the been, past yeah. now, mm-hmm. kind of not innovative anymore, not the great culture. But they are in a completely different place, both financially. So the economic performance has followed. It's like a 7 times increase in their stock. But more than that, the culture is a magnet for talent. The innovation that's flowing from it, the sense of purpose. And it's being led by a trusted and inspired leader, Satya Nadella. So there are people, you know, this is the better way to lead in our new world. A new way of work requires a new way to lead. And I call it trust and inspire. And there are leaders that are doing this really all over the world.
How would you relate to that if you compare it to, let's say, times of when you have the feeling fast decisions have to be made. So there is a magazine in Germany, and one of my fellow colleagues put it onto my desk, where a case was described of an Indian tribe who had two different leaders for different times. They had a war leader, usually a male, and they had a peace leader, usually a female leader. And I found, it's a very black and white example, but I like the idea of saying there are different times and there are different colors of leadership needed in certain times, depending on what the role is. I mean, in modern work, we have different roles in our jobs. Why not different types of leaders for different types in the job? And maybe there is a time, let's say the COVID crisis when it started, I take myself as an example, 30 people, still ramping up the company. And in that moment, I felt I got to take responsibility right now. Of course, I trust everyone in the company. We're very transparent, very open. I trust everyone. But with certain things, I said, I gotta say now, we have to do it that way now. We got to go that. So taking that responsibility. How do you see this adapting leadership, or even different people for different times? Because I love the Satya example, but not everyone has a Satya Nadella in the company.
Right, no, exactly. I think your point is very valid, Christoph, that you think about it, situation, context does matter. And really at a high level, that's my macro argument, which is, for our times today in our world, in society, in a knowledge worker age, in a creative, collaborative, service-based economy, we need trust and inspire type of leadership versus old school command and control industrial age. So at a macro level, I'm arguing the world has changed, and so we need a new style of leader. But even at a more macro level, there might be circumstances and times where different, styles, I call those sub-styles of leadership would maybe be more relevant than others. And sometimes I'm going to be more directive, more personally involved. Other times I might be more truly empowering and hands-off. But I think, so I agree with that. And all the work on leadership styles will talk about the situation, the context does matter. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, though, I'm almost trying to elevate it up to the paradigm level, the fundamental paradigm, the way that we see people and leadership that's even broader than situation and context. What's my paradigm of people? Do I believe in people and their potential? Am I trying to control them or unleash them?
Mm-hmm. And if I get you right, Steve, if I get you right, you say, well, the world is so complex that we will probably never, ever will go back to a time where command and control will work. Even in tough times, even in war times, you need to trust your people, because there's no single person on the planet who is bright enough to say, well, we have to do it like this. So the world is too complex. The markets are too complex. The situations like COVID-19 are too complex to answer them with the one charismatic leader who says, well, I know the direction, this is over. Do I get it right?
Yes. Yeah. That it's just a new environment, and we need a new way to lead with this new world and the new way of, the new work. And we need different style, a different, mega leadership style. But I acknowledge also to Christoph's point that context and situation also will dictate other dimensions of that leadership. So it's not a one size fits all, but at a macro level, at a paradigm level, exactly what you're saying, Michael, that this, we can't go back to the industrial age. It's not going to work. So let me give a current example that just happened, right there in Germany. And this is in the midst of COVID. So Siemens, the global, organization that's I think it's 400,000 plus people globally, right? You know this better than I. But they came out in the midst of COVID, they came out with their mobile working policy. And it was really quite remarkable because they said, our policy, and they said, this will outlive COVID and the pandemic. This is going to be a way going forward. And it's very much around new work. And they said that we're going to have, you know, people can be allowed and expected even to work 2 to 3 days from home or even from anywhere versus only coming into the office, even beyond COVID. So during the pandemic, you might say, well, that's, you have to do it that way in some cases, but they're saying this will outlive this. This is a new way of working. Here's what was impressive to me. A lot of companies right now during a crisis, a pandemic, are kind of coming down with more command and control because they're saying, gosh, now my people aren't always proximate. They're not always present. They're at their homes. What are they doing? So they're putting in place, quote, productivity software, unquote, that may or that for some feels like surveillance, where I, you know, screenshots are being taken of my computers every so often. And what am I working on? And you know, you can, for some, it feels like I'm being micromanaged from a distance. And for some leaders, they're saying, hey, we don't, you know, work from home. We still don't trust you, but we have no choice now. So we're going to try to figure out how to manage. Whereas others are saying, what an opportunity this crisis, this pandemic is giving us to show our people, to demonstrate our people that we trust them. And that we believe in them with expectations and accountability, like green and clean example with my father and me. But, you know, the equivalent of that in a work setting that they can be trusted. And that's what happened with Siemens. So here's from Roland Busch, their deputy CEO, when they announced this mobile working policy, saying 2 to 3 days, work from home, work from anywhere, outliving the pandemic, this is a way of working. He said, these changes will also be associated with a different leadership style, one that focuses on outcomes rather than on time spent at the office. And then listen to this. We trust our employees and we empower them to shape their work themselves so that they can achieve the best possible results. So here during a time of crisis, while some leaders go back to kind of more control because there's a crisis, they're saying we trust and empower more because that's the only way we're going to navigate this new environment. We can't, you know, so that's exactly to the earlier point that you're making, Michael. You can't go back to command and control. You can't do that in today's world. We're going to double down on trusting and extending more trust and empowering more. Again, not a blind trust. A blind trust is where there's no expectations or accountability or where it's just a one size fits all. That's not going to work. It's a smart trust where you kind of use good judgment. But you're, look, you know, Siemens is saying we hire winners at Siemens. And we hire people who can trust. Because if you can't trust your people, you've either got a hiring problem or a leadership problem. And so they're saying, we trust you. You can help shape your work. You got to still achieve the results, but they're being empowered. That inspires people. It brings the best out of them. That's trust and inspire. And so, again, I don't want to try to say everyone has to be Satya Nadella, because you might say, well, that's too out there. I'm saying everyone can kind of learn how to model trust and inspire as a way of operating in today's world. It's learnable as a new way to lead for a new way of working.
Thank you so much, Stephen. think there's nothing open. We very often have two final questions, but I think I would not ask them because you gave us so many gifts, and I'm so thankful for this hour we could spend with you, Stephen. Thank you so much.
But we definitely need to ask you our question for the bucket list.
Oh, do you think? Okay.
You don't want to do the
bucket list question. Okay.
We have one question we always ask at the end. And I can tell you, Michael was now so sucked into what you said that he forgot that question.
I did not forget it. I said it's okay, so the bucket list question is the following. So if you have three things you could write on your bucket list. There's the one thing, the one experience you want to have in your future, the one thing you want to learn, and the one thing you want to give back. What would be the three things on this list?
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. What I would like to experience is I love to travel and to experience new cultures and new things. And this to me is a little bit kind of my new way of work, which is because the work that I do can be done virtually, or I can travel from anywhere to anywhere. A few summers ago, I spent 6 weeks in Germany with my wife and my family. In Granau, near Garmisch, beautiful place, and I kind of just worked out of there, and it was amazing and remarkable, and it gave me a vision that I could do more of this, where I could live not just 6 weeks but maybe a year, and rotate this, and maybe have a few different experiences in different parts of the world, where I can kind of just live and experience life from a new perspective, a new angle. And so maybe, you know, someplace in Europe, maybe someplace in Asia, maybe someplace in Africa, maybe someplace, you know, in China or India, or someplace where I kind of experience life from that vantage point. And just a little taste of what I experienced just for 6 weeks. And I've lived a few other places in my life. I've lived in South America and in Central America. But it's given me a new vision that I would like to experience living in some new places, not necessarily permanently, but just for a period of time. And enough time though, that I feel like I see life from a different vantage point. Mm-hmm. That's, I'd love to experience that. And my experience in Granau and near Garmisch was, you know, that's as pretty a place on earth as there is. And that gave me a real taste of that. So I would like to experience that. And remind me of the other two. I didn't
write. The one thing you want to learn.
Yeah. I want to learn technology better in all its forms so that I don't feel so much dependent upon my son who sent me up here or my assistant. And, you know, because once I'm on the technology, I'm fine. But if anything goes wrong, I just feel like I'm not competent. And it's kind of a new literacy in our world today. And rather than just feeling dependent upon good people to help me, which I'm not, I want to initiate a little bit. I want to be feeling like I'll never be cutting edge because it's just not in my technical, you know, in my makeup. It's not natural. But I want to be good enough that I can initiate and do some things. And because the technology is so interesting and there's so many capabilities and things that we can do. And I want to not just be a laggard. I'll never be a cutting edge person, but I want to be further along the path. And rather than just talk about it, I need to kind of, get into it, dive into it, not be afraid to do it, take it head on and get good at it. And so I told my kids, you know, your nickname for me is not Dad. It's Tech Dad for technology. I'm trying to give myself a new image that I'm good at technology. And I'm trying to do habit 2 and say, I'm going to become good at this. Cool. I'll never be truly great. It's just, you know, it's too cutting edge, but yeah. I want to become better than I am. That's what I want to learn.
Very nice. And the last thing is, what do you want to give back to society?
This is the most important question of all, because life is about contribution, not accumulation. So what I want to give back, I feel like my mission, my calling, is to help increase trust in the world. Because I don't want to just accept that we're in a world of declining trust where it's going down all around us. I acknowledge that's our reality, but I want to counteract that. And I want to be a catalyst along with countless others. So I'm really a co-catalyst with the two of you and many, many others to help bring about a renaissance of trust. And that's a paradox, isn't it? That in the midst of a crisis of trust in our world, what if we could simultaneously have a renaissance of trust, and where we see people and leaders and organizations that are saying there's a better way to lead. There's a better way to operate, to lead out with trust and not allow kind of the lowest common denominator that you can't trust people to become the norm, but instead say, no, what if we could lead with trust and operate this way in a smart way and get results, but also inspire our people along the way. We need leaders that can do that, organizations. We need models. And then models can become mentors. And if we get enough models becoming enough mentors, we can begin to counteract that. And so that's the paradox, that in the midst of the crisis, to help build a renaissance of trust. And to start by just looking in the mirror, starting with myself, my team, my organization, but then rippling out from there. Your team, your organization, rippling out from there. Look at the influence you have through your work of new work and your podcast and the work that you do and the impact that is having. You're rippling out. And that helps build trust in people, in teams, in organizations, in society. So that's the contribution I feel I want to make. We need more trust in our world, not less. And yes, while it takes two or more people to have trust, it only takes one to start. And each of us can be that one. And I want to help instill that vision in every leader I come across, that they can be a co-catalyst with me, with the two of you, and with countless others to help bring about a renaissance of trust in our world.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Danke schön. It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you so much, my friends.
One word, inspired. And what resonated the most with me by far was the story that he shared from his father and the moment when he said he felt trusted. He felt trusted. And we talked about so many times when it comes to feeling is the new kind of leading. And I could really feel this today, that is really the key and the core. And the words that we use quite often when we say trust the process, I would add to that, trust the process, trust the people. And that really can give confidence also to a whole project, even when it comes to a client project. The client says, yeah, but we need the hours, we need to control. Trust the process, trust the people. Word.
Yeah. And always remember the nice story about green and clean.